We're looking forward to a very interesting, exciting 2 days. We have a lot of time for discussions to happen. We have, as you've probably seen from the sessions list, a very diverse group of people here. One of the main motivations for this, for us hosting this conference, was to basically say, we want to host a conference on sustainable development and get people's ideas for what that means. I'm sure you've come across this in your own work. If you say you research sustainable development, people have very different ideas of what they're talking about. And so we want to get people together to try and find common points or differences, or to at least bring together ideas that we feel are important and that everybody in this field should know about or think about or be interested in. So we're looking forward to lots of discussion over the next 2 days. So first, for our opening comments, I'd like to introduce Professor John Mutter, who is the Director of Graduate Studies in our Sustainable Development PhD. He's quite uniquely a Professor of International Affairs and of Earth and Environmental Sciences, and he's very much been at the forefront of the integration of natural and social sciences together. So, without further ado, welcome Professor John Mutter.
Thank you all for coming here. I'm sort of the warm-up act because I know you're here to see Jeff give his talk, so I'll try to be brief and not say too much. Thank you for the introduction. Yes, so welcome to New York if you haven't been here before. Welcome to Columbia if you haven't been here before. And to the School of International and Public Affairs if you haven't been here before. This is actually the youngest school in the university. It was created right after the Second World War, at the end of the Second World War, right about the same time as the UN. And as one of our former deans used to say, it was somewhat flippantly created to teach Americans about the rest of the world. Since at the end of the Second World War, it was pretty clear they didn't know a lot about the rest of the world. The building itself is newer, somewhere in the 70s. And in case you think the architect was Joseph Stalin, it wasn't. It actually had a real architect, and believe it or not, it's meant to look like the UN building, that sort of vertical, those verticalities, and it looks admiringly south towards UN headquarters on 42nd Street, and it's meant to be sort of a pair to the UN because it's international affairs. It is the school that hosts the PhD program in sustainable development here, and although the policy school, the School of International Public Affairs, is the host. We do, as Amir said, attempt to try to merge the social and natural sciences, and I'm trying to do that in my own work and in my own appointment. So I'm jointly appointed, it's not an adjunct, it's a joint appointment in both international public affairs and in earth and environmental sciences, and I'm a geophysicist, I'm a seismologist. To make it worse, I'm a marine control source seismologist. Tiny little piece of that. But it's a very interesting thing. And let me tell you the other thing I do. I'm director of the Earth Institute's postdoctoral fellows program, so which is a program that is about 16 to 18 postdoctoral fellows, all of whom have a focus one way or another, on issues of sustainable development. In fact, it's a sort of a mirror of the PhD program. So if some of you were wondering what on earth you were going to do after you got a PhD with the word sustainable development on it, there's at least one place I know where you can do something for a couple of years. So the program, we had a conference rather similar to this week, twice a year. Half the postdoctoral fellows get up and talk about what they do, and then the second one in a year, the other half of the postdoctoral fellows do it. And the range of interest is interestingly quite similar to the range of interest of the people in our PhD program. We do not constrain people in a discipline sense, but we do constrain them in a way in the things that we ask them to be interested in. The fellows program is funded through the Earth Institute, but we ask that senior investigators co-fund the fellows so that each postdoctoral fellow has some independence because it's base funded by the Earth Institute, and some dependence on a senior researcher because it's partly funded by that senior researcher. So you get some opportunity to spread your wings and a little bit of opportunity to work with a senior person at the Earth Institute. The Earth Institute defined in a very, very broad way. So I'd encourage you to think about that. We've just made our admissions for the year that begins in September this year. I chair the admissions committee, so if you're interested in... Well, we do get a lot of applicants, but it's perhaps useful to mention. We get a lot of applicants, many of whom are not really appropriate in the sense that a lot of people think they're studying sustainable development. I can't always understand why, but it's such a capacious rubric that, you know, it seems to include so much. Very difficult subject to put boundaries on. I don't think it's such a difficult subject to put a center on. A lot of areas like this can be difficult to bracket, but not so difficult to center. So I think we have a fairly clear idea of where our center lies. So our program here is, we had our first intake in 2004, so we're in our, somebody can count, where are we, 2012? So we'll have our 10th anniversary in a couple of years. We now have a full program in the sense that there's students in every year from the first to the fifth. It's a 5th-year program, and there are several people in their 6th year. So they range in their interests and discipline expertise in a way that we encourage very much. We have something of an obsession about ensuring that people learn economics well, and it's not that we think that economists have all the answers, but we do believe that without that grounding, it's very difficult to rationally engage in discussions about sustainable development. So my principal task here this morning was simply to get you seated, get you comfortable, and then introduce Professor Sachs, who I'm pleased to say has arrived. I'm really sorry that I won't be able to attend much of the session, but I'll try to get there tonight. One of our students is defending his dissertation in an hour, and both Jeff and I are on the defense committee speaking the dissertation. Yes. So we have to go away and do that. In fact, it's one of the very most interesting parts of the program in the panel discussion this morning. We have to be somewhere else. So I really hope you enjoy your time here. The program looks wonderful. I'll try to come back in the afternoon and meet you all and listen to your praise of the program that people have set up. So thank you very much, and I welcome Jeffrey Sachs to the stage to provide a keynote presentation.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So, who do we have coming from outside of Columbia? Raise your hands. Good. Welcome. We're absolutely delighted to have you here. I'm director of the Earth Institute, and I'm very proud to welcome you and to host you today. I'm just looking at the topics that you'll be discussing, and I think your topics exemplify the remarkably broad range of challenges that the world is facing right now, and almost every topic that is being discussed is a hard one. You haven't chosen easy subjects. There are very few easy subjects in sustainable development because we don't have long histories and track records of dealing with the range of subjects that the world is grappling with today. So I thought for a few minutes it might be useful for me to give you some perspective from the world of diplomacy and how it interacts with the world of science and scholarship on sustainable development. I both serve as director of the Earth Institute and special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on poverty and development issues. And those increasingly are, of course, sustainable development issues. And so I get to watch the world of diplomacy, and I get to watch the world of science, and those worlds intersect now and then, but not as often as one might think. And it is the gap of national policy making, global diplomacy, and science-based problem solving that may be our biggest challenge of all. The world has entered already the new era of the Anthropocene. I think it's a very important concept that really encapsulates in one new phrase the notion that we're in unexplored territory of humanity. So the Anthropocene, as I'm sure all of you know, or almost all of you know, is a term that was popularized by Professor Paul Crutzen, one of the three Nobel laureates who worked out the atmospheric chemistry of ozone depletion. And the term comes from Greek, meaning the human-made epoch of the planet. It means the era of the Earth in which humanity is overtaken fundamental Earth systems. And carbon is probably the most dramatic of these because of human-induced climate change from fossil fuel use and deforestation. Probably close alongside that is humanity's intersection with the hydrologic cycle. In other words, what we're doing with fresh water, which we need pretty much on an hourly or daily basis to stay alive, is equally frightening. Partly the changes in the hydrologic cycle are due to climate change, and partly they're due to mining of groundwater resources and abstraction of water, blue water so-called, from river flow, from glacier melt, and so on. But we know that we have intervened in this water cycle so significantly that there are places in the world that are already in very deep water crisis, the Sahel and the Horn of Africa, two dryland areas of Africa, have suffered extreme droughts in recent years and massive loss of life as a result of that. And there are a lot of other places that will be in great water stress in the future because groundwater, which has been the lifeline of agriculture, is being rapidly depleted. And the Gangetic Plains and northern China are two areas that are at imminent risk. And the U.S. Midwest, which relies on another deep reservoir, the Ogallala Reservoir, is also just some decades away from similar consequences. Humanity has also intervened in the nitrogen cycle, fundamentally, because best guess is that the chemical deposition of reactive nitrogen as fertilizer feeds about half the planet right now. And without the use of those fertilizers, we'd not come close to feeding 7 billion people. We're not achieving adequate feeding 7 billion people right now, but we would be billions more away from that were it not for chemical nitrogen use. Yet the consequences of chemical nitrogen use are extremely serious for human health, for ecosystem functions, for our water supplies, for the health of our estuaries that are eutrophied by nitrogen runoff, by greenhouse gas emissions that come from the use of chemical fertilizers, nitrous oxide, the pollution that comes from nitrogen oxides that volatilize and so forth, is another part of the Anthropocene. So we've arrived at this new era unexpectedly and largely unaware. And unaware because it's unique to humanity, even though there have been warnings of environmental threats for at least 40 years, and we're going to have a 40th anniversary of the Stockholm Summit and the 20th anniversary of the 1992 Rio Summit in Rio this June. 40 years ago, this looked like a somewhat distant threat, and it was something that would happen in the distant future. I don't think that very many people thought we'd already be in the midst of huge anthropogenic adverse consequences by now. Another way to describe the Anthropocene, which I like and which I'm sure you're aware of, is the article on planetary boundaries and the safe operating room for the planet that was published by Johan Brockström and about 40 other ecologists in Nature magazine a couple of years ago. And like the concept of the Anthropocene, the planetary boundaries concept also elucidated thresholds that are dangerous and that we're quickly surpassing, have surpassed, or soon will surpass, that are of human consequence. Those include, again, climate change, water, nitrogen and phosphorus deposition, loss of biodiversity and habitat, and chemical pollution, and a number of other risks that the ecologists pointed out. So how did this come about without the kind of political, moral, and day-to-day awareness that something so consequential and so grave would call for? And I think the answer is pretty clear: compound interest. The world economy has been growing at a geometric compound rate for decades now, so that 40 years ago in Stockholm, we were at a relatively modest fraction of the human forcings that we are today. The world has been growing at about 4% per year total production. That is now more and more divided between a slow-growing rich world and a still fast-growing emerging economy led by China, India, and others. And at 4 or 4.5% per year, the world economy is doubling faster than every 20 years. And China in particular has been growing at 10% per year for more than 30 years, which means a doubling time every 7 years for 1.3 billion people, for 20% of the world's population. And along with that 7-year doubling has come the most extraordinarily rapid increases of energy use, fossil fuel deployment, a voracious appetite of China for primary commodities from all over the world, for feed grains, for tropical timber, for minerals and so forth from all parts of the world. And we just, in our slow government institutions and diplomatic processes, have not really appreciated how fast these realities could creep up on the world and what it would mean to have what we have today, 7 billion people, an average output per person on the planet now of $10,000 per person when measured in purchasing power adjusted terms. That is a $70 trillion economy that's still growing at a rate of about 4% per year. So one that on the current trajectory would be $140 trillion world economy by essentially 2030. Now, when you watch the diplomatic processes, you realize that nothing moves at that rate. There is no compound interest of diplomatic efficiency or recognition of underlying dangers. Indeed, we seem to move on the 20-year anniversary of conferences more or less almost paralyzed, in fact, from where we were in the preceding moments. And as we come to the Rio Plus 20 conference this June, I think though it won't be the case from the conferees themselves, the government leaders who will be there, the reality for all the rest of us should be a fairly grim reality. Because 40 years after the Stockholm Conference, which was the first global environment conference, and 20 years after the Rio Conference, which set major environmental treaties, the realities of the Anthropocene and planetary boundaries have still eluded real action. Not words, but real action. In Rio 20 years ago, you'll recall, three major multilateral environmental agreements were reached. Big ones, important ones, actually eloquent and well-designed ones. The first was the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which supposedly governs the worldwide effort to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. It said that we're breaching greenhouse gas thresholds, and the world as a whole agrees as a new treaty or new framework convention to head off that dangerous anthropogenic interference. The second major treaty was the Convention on Biological Diversity, and that treaty recognized the fact that the human-induced destruction of natural habitat, climate change, pollution, and other anthropogenic forcings were causing a grave threat to millions of species around the world, and that we needed to slow down and then stop the loss of biodiversity out of a moral commitment as well as out of a very practical consideration of how we grow our food and how we reap ecosystem services for safe water and protection against pests and pathogens and disease burden. The third treaty that was reached in 1992 was the Convention to Combat Desertification, which is barely even heard of anymore. But the reality of desertification, which broadly means the loss of utility of drylands, not necessarily to sand dunes, but to environmental degradation, has proceeded rapidly in certain dryland parts of the world. And my own view is that the drylands that stretch across the Sahel from Senegal, Mali, Niger, Chad, and then into East Africa, the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, Djibouti, Eritrea, and then continuing northeast across the Arabian Peninsula into Yemen, and then Iran and Iraq, and then into Western and Central Asia, a whole 12,000 mile dryland belt that culminates in Central Asia in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other Central Asian states, is a tinderbox right now, not only of drylands becoming drier and suffering more extreme droughts, but of the violence that goes along with hunger and instability and lack of perception of safety in the future. So three big treaties reached in Rio, and will come now 20 years later, and I think it's right to say not one of them has been enforced in any serious way. The Climate Change Convention gave rise to the Kyoto Protocol. The United States never joined it. The so-called non-Annex I countries, which are the emerging markets and poorer countries, weren't called upon to join it under the treaty because the rich countries were to move first. And the emissions are considerably higher today than in 1990. We haven't really even turned the needle downward. If there's any slowdown of emissions, it's only because of economic crisis, not really because of policy changes. And in the emerging economies, while China and others are taking on new investments in low carbon energy, they're also taking on major investments in coal-fired power plants and in other carbon-intensive energy sources. When it comes to biological diversity, this treaty disappeared from sight, at least in the United States. The U.S. never even signed the treaty. Signed it, never ratified it. And we can thank Newt Gingrich, a man of many accomplishments in helping to destroy our country, as one of the reasons for this, because Newt Gingrich was then Speaker of the House of the U.S. Congress, and he said the Convention on Biological Diversity threatened private property. That is the right of private landowners to destroy biological diversity, a much prized right of the American right wing. And this never passed the U.S. Congress. So when it came time to achieve the targets of the CBD, especially the target to slow significantly the loss of biological diversity by the year 2010, no one even heard of that goal, at least not in the United States. I think in Europe there was a stray story here and there, but there never was a global mobilization, as you might think for something so consequential. And when it comes to the drylands and the desertification treaty, I think it's really fair to say that the drylands are the most ignored place in the planet until violence takes hold, and then the response is not bore wells but drone missiles. And so we have a spreading amount of violence in the drylands, both internally and then in response from NATO and the United States, which is fighting wars, either overt or clandestine, all through the drylands regions, but is not digging bore wells and not addressing the deeper challenges of sustainability. So this is the world that you are taking on in the challenges of sustainable development. And it's not a happy picture, because probably the deepest part of the global economic DNA is the urge for continued economic growth. And for developing countries, this is perfectly sensible and understandable in particular, because poorer countries have more urgent material needs, for example, to spread an electricity grid that doesn't exist right now, or to spread transport and housing and other infrastructure that's part of a modern life and that presumably will raise economic well-being and life expectancy and so on. For the rich countries, the quest to just keep moving fast and grow is a little bit less understandable, but it's also pretty deep in our DNA. Neither Barack Obama nor Mitt Romney is campaigning on a platform of stabilizing the U.S. economy to avoid dangerous anthropogenic forcing of the planet. They're both campaigning on who can grow faster, and both candidates more or less are saying, though Romney more than Obama, that we have to develop and use our natural resources to ensure job creation and economic growth as a very high priority. So the momentum is very, very strong. And the challenge of meeting the true planetary boundaries or living in a sensible way in the Anthropocene has not yet engaged the core of national politics almost anywhere. So what does that mean in practice for us as scholars, for you as budding scientists and academics? Where does that leave us? I'll shift to some good news. Mild good news. I can't say it's dramatic good news. But I would say that beneath the surface of political paralysis and lack of political interest and politics driven by oil lobbies and coal companies and others, the public is step by step becoming more aware that something dangerous is happening. And there was an opinion survey a couple of days ago published in the New York Times, which showed that about 70% or so of the U.S. public attributed the increasing instability of climate, for instance, the drought that is very deep and severe in the American Southwest, to long-term human-induced change. And this is extremely important, because while the politicians are ignoring these issues by and large, the public is experiencing them. And the public is getting a sense that something is wrong. It's a little bit of a shame that warnings don't work, but maybe human experience and the direct reflection on the fact that we have 80 degree Fahrenheit days in New York City in March, and we had basically a winter that was not really winter here, and that the lower 48 states of the United States experienced the highest temperatures in measurement history in the first 3 months of 2012, and that the number of tornadoes, though not definitively linked yet to, or linked to anthropogenic climate change, is extraordinarily high and extraordinarily costly, is making people think and making people want to react. So the way that this is translating slowly, grudgingly, but perhaps with some use into the diplomatic arena, what I'm hoping will happen in the Rio Plus 20 summit in the third and fourth week of June of this year is that the world will adopt a new set of goals that will follow the Millennium Development Goals. The Millennium Development Goals, as you know, have been goals to fight poverty, hunger, and disease, and over a 15-year period from the start of the millennium to 2015. I've been involved strongly with the MDGs as advisor on the MDGs to first Kofi Annan and now Ban Ki-moon. And my take is that they've had a real effect, because they have been goals that civil society in many places of the world embraced, and that governments were pushed to endorse, and that step by step started to feed into actual policy change in many poor countries, and more of a focus on child survival, maternal survival, kids at school, fighting disease, raising agricultural productivity, and so forth, which are part of the MDGs. The idea now is that in the post-2015 period, the MDGs will be followed by SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. I like it, personally. I like the idea that we'll have a flag out there, presumably for the next 15 years, where kids all over the world, and your students, and policymakers, and the general public will be hearing the phrase sustainable development over and over again. And they will be forced to ask, what does that mean? What are sustainable development goals? Why do we have them? Can we achieve them? When I came to Colombia a decade ago to be the head of the Earth Institute, I was asked what I'd like my title to be, and I said I want to be called Professor of Sustainable Development, which I am, Catalet Professor of Sustainable Development. And I said the reason I want that is so when I tell someone that that's what I am, they could say, what's sustainable development? And then I could explain it to them. So at least I could go retail one by one try to educate the world on this challenge of combining a highly productive, still growing world economy and population with these planetary boundaries. It seems that the world is going to adopt SDGs. And of course, I like the branding of going from MDGs to SDGs, just one letter difference. And there's a certain brand that has developed around the MDGs. I wouldn't say it rivals Coca-Cola yet, but it still rivals other things in the development business. And going to SDGs, I think, is a nice transition that can build on that branding. So what will the SDGs be? Of course, that is yet to be determined. And one risk is that as it does get determined, the fight over them becomes so severe that we never agree on them. That's the biggest danger. The notion, though, is that the SDGs would reflect a triple bottom line vision of society for the first time. And that would mean that the goals of economic development, environmental sustainability, and social inclusion would all be put on a par and as an interconnected objective of society. So on the economic development side, there would presumably be a continued commitment, for example, to fighting poverty. Not only achieving the Millennium Development Goals, but going further, I hope, to commit to ending extreme poverty within a certain period, the year 2030, for example. The world as a whole did succeed in cutting by half poverty rates from 1990, when they stood at about 44% in the developing world, to the current rate of about 21% poverty rate. Most of the gain was in China and Asia, but even Africa is now starting to see the poverty rates come down. And I hope that the first pillar of the SDGs would be finish that job. On the environmental side, of course, we have to define what are the risks, and I think the planetary boundary framework to be a good starting point. And what I like about the planetary boundary, which is a circle of threats identified by these ecologists in the Nature magazine article, is that they can be described really in four categories. One is a sustainable energy system, which means a transition to a low carbon energy system primarily, to head off climate change, and also to resist the implications of depletion of conventional oil. Second is sustainable agriculture, which means growing enough food for the planet in a way which addresses climate change, biodiversity, habitat, water stress, invasive species, and so forth, which are all side effects of our food system. So we have, I would say the food system is the number one driver of human-induced change on the planet, because it gets into land in every possible way. It destroys habitat, it contributes to greenhouse gases, it leads to invasive species, it depletes groundwater, it puts chemical pesticides into the planet, it's responsible for the bulk of reactive nitrogen deposition and all of the consequences of heavy use of reactive nitrogen. So that's the second part. The third, I would say, is sustainable industry, which is mainly heavy industry cleaning up after itself, which it manifestly does not do, for example, in China right now, which is probably the most polluted place in the world because of the heavy concentration of heavy industry and on major river systems like the Yangtze River that collect massive, massive amounts of effluents and discharges have created water hazards for hundreds of millions of people as well as air hazards. And the fourth dimension of this sustainability pillar, I would say, is urban sustainability. The fact that we're in an urban world, we are now more than half urban, first time in our species history. We'll probably become 70% urban by the year 2030 or so. We have mega metropolitan areas, increasingly often 20 or 30 million people, and these are not yet healthy for human life and human well-being. And the ecosystems of those regions. And so sustainable urbanization, I would put as the fourth pillar. It's easy to name them. It's hard to achieve these goals. But at least they will be defined as to what we need to do. And if we could come to sustainable energy, sustainable agriculture, sustainable industry, and sustainable urban areas, we'd also, by definition, if you look one by one, stay within the planetary boundaries. We would address the problems of climate change, water, biodiversity loss, pollution, and so on. The third part of the SDGs will probably be something around social inclusion. Most societies around the world are becoming less equal. Internally, even if there's some measure of equality across the world as poor countries achieve economic growth, within China or within India, certainly within the United States, inequality has risen. And we know that this is inequality not just of income and wealth, but also of political power, voice, environmental safety. And the U.S. economy, which I know the best, is my own ability to make this assessment, is really becoming a two-track society, one in which there is a relatively small, extremely well-provisioned upper class, and increasingly where the middle class is under shock or depletion, and the ranks of the poor have increased considerably. And so inclusion becomes not just a nice catchphrase, but absolutely an imperative for social stability, and I would say for moral decency of the society. Now, the idea of the global diplomacy is that if it works, that in Rio, the world will adopt the concept of adopting SDGs. So the process will be divided into three parts. First, the world's governments meeting in Rio will say, we will have sustainable development goals to follow the MDG period. Then there will be a whole diplomatic process. What should these SDGs be? There will be a high-level commission, for example, in which David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the UK, and counterparts from Africa, Asia, and Latin America will try to define as government leaders what these goals will be. There will be UN processes. There will be the debate of us in civil society, what should be in there. Then the third phase will be, presumably, in September 2013, when the world's governments will come to the UN for a special session to review the Millennium Development Goals and adopt a set of recommendations put forward by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on a new set of sustainable development goals. It's a little bit treacherous because when the Millennium Development Goals were adopted, the world leaders didn't quite know what they were adopting. They were part of a large document that everybody said, great! Whereas this time, everybody's focused. And if the lawyers get their hands on this, we're all in trouble. Because once the legalities and the legalisms and the individual words come to dominate, that can frustrate progress tremendously. Goals need not be perfect. They should be aspirational, inspirational, motivational. But they need not be perfect. And lawyers fight for the perfection of their clients in some sense, rather than the practicalities. So I'm hoping that this timetable prevails, and I'm hoping that from the point of view of our profession, we then have a global commitment to sustainable development goals, to the triple bottom line of fighting poverty, avoiding planetary boundaries, promoting social inclusion, and then drawing upon knowledge. So let me just finish with that observation and turn it over for a couple of questions or comments if there are. How can we actually meet these sustainable development goals? How would the world actually make a transition to a low-carbon energy system in the face of the reality that coal remains the cheapest form of electricity, for example, and solar power, while plentiful, is more expensive and is intermittent, and therefore requires high-priced storage, just as one example. The answer is, of course, we would need public policies, incentive systems, subsidies, taxation, regulation, all of the panoply of policymaking. But before that, we would need the public understanding and the public will of why we're doing this and why it's so important for the planet's health and the well-being of the world and the well-being of future generations. My view is that even unenforceable, purely motivational goals like the MDGs or like the Sustainable Development Goals can play an important role in steering a complicated and noisy world in the right direction. And it's also my belief that we in the knowledge community can play an extremely important role in adding content and further motivation to such goals by showing how they can actually be achieved. For me, as advisor on the Millennium Development Goals, part of my work was saying that it's important to keep impoverished kids alive and that that can be done by fighting disease. But it was even more important to be able to say, here's what precisely can be done on malaria control in order to get the death rates down sharply. And why do we know it? Because that's what the malariologists have said and determined. And so mobilizing the knowledge communities is crucial for public policy making. And the policymakers don't often know it. I don't know if we have 5 PhDs in the US Congress out of 535 members. It doesn't seem like it. The level of scientific ignorance, willful ignorance, pandering to lobbies and so forth is pretty discouraging. But I believe that we need, as a scientific community, to raise our voices in very clear, methodical, careful, detailed, but intelligible ways, not just in journals, which are largely unintelligible, but intelligible ways so that the public can understand what's at stake and what the real choices are that confront the society. One of the things I'm hoping that the Earth Institute will do going forward is help to be part of a global node of a global network on sustainable development, like our meeting today, where we can help to bring experts from around the world together to do analysis, testing of propositions, arguments, costing of alternatives, preparation of scenarios, and critical pathways to help the public to understand what actually can be done, what the choices are, what the trade-offs are, and what the possibilities are. The Secretary General has asked me to help to create such a network, starting after Rio, by bringing together research centers and universities around the world, largely online, through some targeted activities to take these global goals and show how they can be achieved country by country, region by region, around the world. That's going to be your homework assignment, by the way. because you're going to have to play a critical role in that. And what we're committed to doing is to network with all of you, to use improved social networking tools, online crowdsourcing methods, ways to have international conferences, both in person, but through webinars and through global meetings, and to have websites that really do host global problem solving in a very active way so that we can play what I believe will be our indispensable role. Thank you very much. And can you speak up just a little bit? Yeah, so that's a great question. What does it really mean to have sustainable development? Does it mean to stop economic growth? Does it mean to stop economic growth in rich countries but let poor countries catch up? Does it mean to decouple what we call economic growth from primary commodity use? Is that possible? Is there a way to have something like economic progress, however it's measured and defined, but at the same time, major reductions of carbon emissions, for example? So this is, I think, what needs to be worked out. My own view is that meaningful economic progress, but I'm using slippery terms, not necessarily as defined by GNP the way we do it right now, but something correlated with that can continue even at a global level while we decouple that progress from more intensive resource use and indeed turn the direction around and reduce the anthropogenic burdens on the planet. So that would mean, for example, a shift from not so much a decline of energy use, which I think will be very hard if some meaningful economic progress is to continue for 7 billion people, but a decarbonization of energy by much greater use of clean and renewable sources, particularly solar power, debatably nuclear power, which is it's low carbon, but potentially quite dangerous from a proliferation point of view, and other sources that may be applicable. Can it be the case that we meet global food needs and at the same time reduce sharply the reactive nitrogen that is polluting water and air and contributing to greenhouse gases? That would be another kind of decoupling. Different farm practices, different agronomic practices, different kinds of tillage, different kinds of seed varieties, different kinds of irrigation might make it possible to do that. I personally believe that we will need cutting-edge technology, smart grids, and an ability to tap alternative energy systems and an ability to get nutrients to soil roots more directly through drip irrigation and other fertigation and other methods, that it's not a matter of reverting to simpler technologies, nor is it a matter of stopping economic growth, but rather it's a matter of harnessing sustainable technologies. That's my own guess. So I'm in the camp that says it's possible to decouple economic growth and anthropogenic forces. Other people say that's wishful thinking. That's a kind of blindness to, that's bowing to consumerism and so forth, and it's not really possible. And I think we don't really know fully, because the amount of analytical work on what's really possible for the energy system or what's really possible for sustainable agriculture has not been engaged to the depth and experience that we need to answer this question. Yeah? No. Well, let me say, it's from an economist's answer is pretty straightforward. You have to tax the bad. And that's fine, and it's an insight. But I don't find it much of an answer. Because depending on what the technological choices are, that may mean a grinding halt to growth because those are the true ecological limits. Or it might mean a continuation of growth because there's sufficient substitutability toward and decoupling towards low-impact technologies. So the economist knows one thing, get the prices right, or get the incentives right, but the economist does not know the substitutability and the potential within a constraint for what might happen because that's the job of technology and science. And unless these two perspectives are wedded together, I don't think we get very far, actually. So my view is that economists have had too much say in this so far because they've said, oh, that's easy, just cap and trade, or that's easy, put a carbon tax on, or that's easy, tax fertilizer, something. But that doesn't tell you what the outcome will be. And that doesn't really describe, therefore, what the relevant trade-offs are. For that, you need to know the production function, to put it in economist terms. But the production function is not what an economist thinks. It's not Cobb Douglas or constant elasticity of substitution or translog or some other convenient mathematical form. The production function is concentrated solar thermal, or it's carbon capture and sequestration, or it's low tillage agriculture. In other words, it's complex technological systems. It's not a mathematical equation. And that's where I fault my own profession, which is economics, as forgetting that what counts is not the econometric estimate of a production function, but what counts is a deeper understanding of what the real technological possibilities are, especially on parts of these trade-offs which society has not yet explored. So my own view, not everybody's taste, my own view is that the discussions are most fruitful when you put technologists and economists and psychologists and others in the room together, and that you mix the disciplines so that each of these perspectives can be brought to bear. And I think we need to do that if we're going to explore parts of reality that we don't have right now, but niches to which we're trying to move the international system. I'll take one more because I actually have to go make a thesis defense. Please.
I had a couple of notes today anyway. The other thing for Rio Plus 20 is green economy.
Yeah.
Do you have a wonderful, inspiring 2 minutes or 1 minute explanation of what you'd like to see as a result of that?
Well, this is the same issue, it's just packaged a different way. So green economy is the phrase to tell people, don't worry, you can have economic growth, but it should be environmentally sound. And the poor countries are saying, oh, wait a minute, you're going to make us pay three times more for electricity, forget it. And the rich countries are saying, well, this is, not all rich countries, but some. Well, but that's okay. This will all work out. But it's a phrase, in my opinion, that is...
not the 15 principles?
Now, I don't find content in this adequate yet. Because I view it as the same point as sustainable development. Can you combine economic progress in some sense? And I always say that because we measure it by GNP primarily, but we know that that's so flawed from the point of view of well-being that one gap is from GNP to well-being and the other gap is from resources to GNP or whatever it is. But I think the green economy is a slogan. It's And there are two claims to the slogan. You know, one is kind of the claim that I subscribe to in a way, but not as a simple answer and not known, that you can decouple economic progress and natural resource use in a meaningful way. That's one part. There's another claim of green economy, much more exciting, which is it'll create lots of jobs and it's going to be great for the economy and it's the new boom and it's the new industrial revolution and so forth. I have real doubts about that. And I have real doubts about that because I think mainly we are in the business now of incurring increased costs to what we do to avoid even greater losses down the road. I don't think we're in the joy in the period of incurring these costs for a great boom ahead. And I think a practical thought experiment is the following. Some people say, oh, it's so great, it's going to stimulate renewable energy and all the rest. And one thought experiment is, suppose it was discovered tomorrow, as the climate skeptics would say, greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide is not a greenhouse gas, and there is no effect. Would we, for the sake of a green economy, for all the excitement ahead, still spend $1 trillion to limit carbon emissions? I don't think so. But the greatest enthusiasts of the green economy say, oh, it's all win-win. There's no loss. It's just going to be so exciting. So my view is we've got costs to bear. We're going to bear them because the current trajectory could be devastating, would be devastating. We have to bear costs to avoid even greater costs. How big are those costs that we have to bear? For some, the costs are fundamental end to a growing world economy. We have to just get off the capitalist kick. It's a disaster. And we have to stop growth and move to a stationary economy. That's one vision. And then around that could be psychological theory, it'll all be better for us or whatever. There's another vision that says we don't have to do anything because those costs are in the minds of environmental advocates that are, you know, peddling their myths. That's the U.S. almost uniquely U.S. environmental skeptics, but that's mainly paid for by industry. Then there's a view in the middle, which says if we bear a reasonable cost, we can head off these dangers and still have the kind of economic life that most people actually aspire to. They'd like a house, they'd like electricity, they actually want a car, and so forth, and so on. And that's the decoupling idea. And these are empirical questions that I think are pretty deep and that are really incumbent upon us to analyze much harder, try to solve, do by demonstration, encourage R&D, and so forth. Because the more we can decouple, the better off we are. The more we have to say everything has changed, there's no room for more growth, the poor, it's tough, or the rich, all you have to do is cut your living standard by half. That'll be a great presidential campaign when the candidates are encouraging Americans to slash their living standards for the sake of the world. Nobody would win that election. So I hope decoupling is right. In some broad sense, but it's a set of technological and economic questions that will determine whether that's the case or not. The green economy is sometimes a slogan to say, of course there's a way, and it doesn't even cost anything, it's just going to be a boom. And I think that's as misdirected as the one that says we have no risks at all. It's trying to peddle the easy answer to what's a very complicated situation. Let me conclude by welcoming, again, all of you, and enjoy a very productive day, which I know is on tap. And again, you're part of the network. So as you watch these goals be formulated and adopted, I hope we can count on you to stay very actively involved
so that we can be debating these issues and trying to find a way ahead together. Thanks a lot.